Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
And you're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show on podcast. We have a great guest for you, someone who's done something really interesting, Drew Corrali, who's an MD, PhD. We'll find out a little more about his background. He probably was an elite training in the medical scientist training program someplace, so we'll find out about that. But he is an elite. He is an assistant professor of psychiatry and neuroscience at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital, New York. But he had a really landmark paper come out relating to cocaine addiction. It was in a very prestigious journal, Nature, and he found that a common thing that we have, granulocyte stimulating factors, something that stimulates your white cells to produce more white cells, if you will, your bone marrow to produce more white cells, probably to help you fight infection, also affects at least the mouse's desire for cocaine, but not for other rewards, and a specific brain region that is often associated with addiction, the nucleus accumbens, is affected by this. Drew, thanks very much for coming on and tell us a little more about what you found.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for the very kind introduction. It's good to be here. So my lab is interested in the interconnection between the immune system and the brain in psychiatric illness, specifically in addiction. And so what we did in the study is to try and see how it is that changes in immune system function might be affecting behavioral responses to drugs of abuse, in this case cocaine, to try and see how if that might be a potential therapeutic target for helping addicts in the future. So what we did was we performed a screen of the blood of animals that had been treated with either cocaine or saline for a long time, and looked at about 40 different immune proteins in the blood, things that are related to inflammation and immune function. And from that, we found that there's this one particular protein, this granulocyte colony stimulating factor, that was increased by cocaine, and the amount that it increased actually correlated with the behavior. So animals that had higher levels of this protein were the animals that were administering themselves more cocaine. So we then went on to do behavioral experiments.
So the cocaine actually increased, caused the increase, which then caused a reaction in the brain to further heighten their high, if you will, from the cocaine.
Yeah, that's what it seems like, and the cocaine caused an increase of this protein. Both in the blood and in the brain.
And now, does that occur with other, if you will, addictive substances such as alcohol or opiates or even sugar? Do we know that those change the granulite stimulating factor?
You know, no one has ever looked into how those other addicting substances might affect the GCSF. There is some literature that other addicting substances can affect other inflammatory mediators, but no one has looked at this specific one before.
Now you must have at least thought about looking at it, since your lab is on the forefront of this, and probably if you've looked at it but can't tell us yet because the manuscripts are in preparation or the abstracts are in preparation, that's okay to say it. By the way, this is from the Drew Corrali's website is Corrali, K-I-R-A-L-Y, lab, L-A-B, .com, at the Icahn School of Medicine. So, Drew, have you started to look at this at all?
To look at this protein with other addictive substances?
Yes.
We actually are just now looking at that. So we're starting to do some assays looking at how it might affect response to opiates, because that's obviously a major public health crisis right now, and also have a manuscript in preparation looking at how it might affect response to rewards like sugar and those sorts of things. So, yeah, we're kind of branching out a little bit to see what other behaviors it might affect.
So let's go back. You can give us a little. I promise not to break any abstract or publication bias, but if you want to give us hints on that as you talk about the cocaine, that'd be great. But tell us now, you also not only found that this increase, but that there are things you can do with GCSF, and tell us what GCSF stands for. I mentioned about granulocyte stimulating, but you can tell us specifically. But you've done things to manipulate the receptor on in the nucleus accumbens for that, and what effects have that had? I mean, in other words, that's potential treatment, at least for the mice, maybe for humans.
Yeah, definitely. So, GCSF, it stands for granulocyte colony stimulating factor. It's actually something that was discovered over 30 years ago and for its ability to mobilize stem cells from the bone marrow and increase white blood cells in the blood. But its receptor also, the receptor for this protein also exists in the brain. And so what we did to try and figure out, where the locus of effect in the brain was we put in an antibody to block the GCSF from ever reaching its receptor. And when we put it specifically into the nucleus accumbens, that reward region of the brain, it actually blocked the formation of preference for cocaine in those animals, which is potentially really exciting. You know, if we were able to block the effects of this protein, it might be something that could actually be used for treatment in humans down the road.
Is there any way of one doing this without affecting your, your responses to, or your ability to fight infections? In other words, is the GCSF receptor in the nucleus accumbens able to be targeted in any way that wouldn't also affect the GCSF receptor that helps you fight infections?
Right. And it's a really good question. It's an important question when we start thinking about humans. I would say it's a two-part answer. One is that we can't directly differentiate the receptor in the brain from the periphery, but we're starting to look in the brain to see if there are any sort of other pathways that are manipulated by GCSF that we could more directly target. And the other thought is that, you know, the idea of giving people antibodies to inflammatory proteins is something that's actually become very common. And so antibodies against TNF-alpha and other similar cytokines are used to treat rheumatoid arthritis and other conditions, and people are able to tolerate them pretty well. So it is possible that if we block the effects of this one protein, it wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing for the patients that were taking it.
And now you've also, I mean, probably if you look at addictions, and I don't know this offhand, but probably alcohol is number, I mean, probably sugar is number one, and then alcohol would be number two, and then I assume opiates is number three, but I don't know that. In other words, cocaine, it takes a fairly, it's a cardiovascular death if you have it from high blood pressure or heart arrhythmias, whereas opiates depress your ability to breathe and can probably kill you faster. Opiates are probably more severe consequence, but what's the history of addictions? I don't know what's the prevalence rate or the incidence rate in the United States now.
Yeah, so I mean, clearly at this point in time, opiates have been, to use the term, sort of resurgent in terms of addiction, and that we've seen a lot more patients using them, a lot more patients overdosing. And like you mentioned, they're some of the most dangerous drugs in overdose. Among illicit drugs, though, cocaine is sort of the second most common in terms of any sort of major morbidity, mortality kind of effects. And so the cocaine overdose is not entirely uncommon. And I actually just saw some information the other day suggesting that it might be becoming more common now, that it had been on the decline before and is now increasing. So, it is still something that is a real problem in society. There are several million people across the country that are do suffer from cocaine use disorder. So it is something that is, it kind of receives less public attention now, but it's still a very important problem.
You're listening to an interview on You, the Owner's Manual radio show. We're talking about addiction and his substantial discovery relating to cocaine addiction, maybe to other addictions, in a way that gives us hope of some blocking of the addiction, if you will, reward that causes the addiction or that augments the addiction, with Dr. Kiraly, K-I-R-A-L-Y. He's at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. If you want to find out more, you can find out more information in addition to listening to the rest of this interview by going to Kiraly, K-I-R-A-L-Y lab, lab.com. You're funded by a number of government agencies as well as private foundations. He is a really fast and wonderful, if you will, trajectory in his research career and in the ability of this to translate, if you will, the basic science into something that's good for our clinical use. I'm sure he'd accept private funding as well. So if you want to send, you can probably go to the website and find out how to support that research, but it is KiralyLab.com. Dr. Kiraly, now tell us why. Now, you say that there is a chance of being able to target this in brain as opposed to in the periphery where we might use the GCSF stimulation to fight infections. Now, cocaine doesn't increase our ability to fight infections. So does it just increase the GCSF in brain, or does it do it in periphery? And do we see, or is it its other effects on epinephrine and norepinephrine, that we don't fight infections well if we're cocaine addicted?
Yeah, so there actually is pretty good evidence out there that patients who are using cocaine actually have a harder time fighting off infections, and that cocaine may be in some ways immunosuppressive and make people more prone to getting infections. Kind of one of the more researched ones is that people who are using cocaine are more likely to get an active HIV infection. Exactly why it is that the cocaine increases the GCSF is something that we're still working on. We found that if we gave cocaine only in the periphery, there's a kind of cocaine that doesn't get into the brain, it actually didn't increase levels of GCSF in the brain. So it seems like it's something where the cocaine actually needs to be in direct contact with the cells that are in there, and it's not just diffusing in from the periphery.
And now we've seen a lot of what we call implantable devices used in the brain, such as there are electrical stimulators used for Parkinson's disease and used for some other movement disorders and used for epilepsy. Mm-hmm. Are there any that, for example, give a drug that could be an antibody essentially to this protein used in the brain? Do you know of any studies on that? I mean, there are cancer drugs administered that way. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe there. I've heard of studies being done like that in cancer. I've never heard of anything, you know, certainly in the kind of like neuropsychiatric realm. I've never heard of anything where drug is delivered directly, into the brain or spinal cord. It would potentially be interesting because the antibodies that we're using don't cross the blood-brain barrier. So if you inject them peripherally, they don't get into the brain. So if there were a way to get them directly into the brain without doing damage, that would be that would certainly be of interest.
Now, you've studied this in mice. Are there other species that you've studied this in as well?
So the paper that we published had mice and rats in it, but we haven't gotten above looking at it in rodents at this point. I have some active efforts going on here at Mount Sinai to try and recruit patients so that we can look in the serum of patients who are using cocaine or other drugs to see if GCSF is affected in humans as well. So that is ongoing, but we haven't gotten any data on it yet.
Now, the other thing is your laboratory looks at the interaction between the immune system and the microbiome. That is, what changes in the bacteria inside you. Do people with cocaine or with opiates or with other addictions have a different bacterial makeup in their gut, and does this in some way affect their brain?
Yeah, so it seems like the answer is yes, that people who are taking either cocaine or opiates have changes in their gut microbiome. And some of that may be due to direct effects of the drug. Some of it may be due to some of the changes in diet and lifestyle that go along with heavy use of drugs, and that's something that isn't entirely clear. Our lab is doing work and has found that changing the gut bacteria actually changes the way animals respond to drugs of abuse and changes their kind of preference for the drug. It makes the drug more or less rewarding depending on how you manipulate the gut bacteria. So that's something that we're also looking at as a potential possible treatment strategy to kind of help reduce relapse in patients.
Oh, isn't that interesting? So it might be that we gave a probiotic of a specific bacterial makeup, and that would change the feeling of reward or of a high from one of the addictive drugs. Is that what you're implying?
Yeah, I think that's the idea. And, you know, I don't know if it would be something that would block the high, but I think my hope for it would be that if you can change the bacterial makeup of the gut, it might be able to help reduce some of the craving that patients feel from drugs. And it seems like that's what we're seeing in the animals, is that in models of kind of drug relapse, we're able to affect their craving for the drug.
Now, my on-site assistant professor, Bridget, wants to know, she just asked me, does ethanol, does alcohol or marijuana also work through the nucleus accumbens? In other words, is the nucleus accumbens the reward center for other drugs such as alcohol and marijuana?
Yep. So, yeah, basically all drugs of abuse affect activity in the nucleus accumbens. And it seems to be that it pretty much serves as a reward center for drugs of abuse, as well as things like sugar and palatable food. All the drugs work through different mechanisms, and so they're affecting different signaling pathways to get there, but they're all affecting the nucleus accumbens.
So let me go and summarize what I've taken from this, and you correct me if I'm wrong. We're talking with Dr. Corrali, a Leon Levy fellow in neuroscience, as well as the Seaver Family Foundation postdoctoral fellow, which supported his work in his development, who runs the Laboratory of Translational Psychiatry at Mount Sinai at the Icahn School of Medicine. And it is CorraliLab.com to find out more. But what I've learned, Drew, and it's Drew Corrali, K-A-R-A-L-Y, what I've learned, Drew, is that the nucleus accumbens is a reward center. It heightens rewards by stimulation of the GCSF protein, or the granulate colony stimulating protein, something that also increases your white cell production. But in the brain, it seems to stimulate your reward center, at least for cocaine and maybe for other drugs of use and abuse. And that blocking this receptor experimentally in the brain can, in fact, block the reward-seeking behavior of mice and rats. Is that correct so far?
Yeah, that is correct. And the one thing I would add to that we found that I think is really important is that it actually didn't affect the animal's interest in seeking out food, so just regular food. So it seemed that it was affecting their response to drugs of abuse without affecting kind of normal behaviors of their daily lives, which is something when you think about with human patients would be really important.
That's actually too bad, because it would be great to decrease food seeking behavior in people too. that's a joke.
Yeah, no, that's certainly true. But we weren't looking at mice that had any sort of problematic eating habits, I don't think. So we haven't quite gotten to that yet.
I hope you will keep us informed. Producer Donna, I hope will keep us informed of your progress, Drew, and we want to have you back on as more discoveries are made. We've been talking with I didn't even get to the basic question I wanted to answer. Are you an MSTP? Is this part of the medical scientist training program is where you came from, or did you do your MD and PhD separately?
So I did my combined MD PhD at UConn. The program actually lost its MSTP grant right after I started there, and I think they've regained it now. But it was a program that was modeled after the MSTP programs.
So we should say that this is really the elite way people are trained to be medical scientists, and this is the group that has made the most difference to scientific progress in the United States and throughout the world since we've been leading that, is this medical scientist training program. I'm bringing that up because I think it's important to make sure as we go forward that if funding for our research endeavors gets reduced, that it isn't for the juniors in the medical scientist training program, because that has been the most productive. And Drew Corrales' work, KRALYlab.com, Drew Corrales' work is typical that these interface advances occur with the combination of people who are at the interfaces of two fields, such as an MD and PhD, and Drew's state is. So thanks very much, Drew, for coming on. Thank you for downloading us and listening. Hope you'll rate us. And thanks, Randall, for great engineering. Again, KRALYlab.com, KRALYlab.com at Mount Sinai.